All right, so I have the pleasure to talk about these non-Gauss entity results from Planck. And thank you to Paul and James for setting the scene for me already. I anticipated that they would talk more about the interpretation of these results in terms of non-standard inflationary models. So I will try to give a more general perspective of the approach we took for deriving these constraints from the data. And while I speak on this topic, I should also emphasize that while Sabino Matarese and I led the non-Gaussian entity analysis for Planck in terms of the model constraints for sort of physically motivated templates, this is obviously a large team effort where many people were involved, amongst them Paul, James, Michele, Bacia Fontent, several teams of people who contributed. And I have to say that it was actually, for such a large team effort, quite a civilized experience to get from beginning to end. So Planck presented us with this view of the primordial quantum perturbations. It's obviously a processed view, but this is where we try to look for constraints on primordial physics, on the mechanism for the formation of structure, and try to look for hints of interesting signals. Now, the technique that is generally used, in this case for temperature alone, given the release of the Planck data, but the technique that's generally used is to take this map and then reverse time so that from the time of emission at 380,000 years, we can look back and actually study the quantum perturbations only a tiny fraction of a second after the Big Bang. And the ability to do that derives from linear physics. And in everything I say, I will assume that linearity holds in that regime for translating the quantum perturbations in the initial curvature perturbation into the CMB anisotropies that we see. Also should emphasize that at this point, we've not considered there are possibilities for, this is for an adiabatic perturbation. What I'm showing here is a CMB simulation and reconstructed slices of primordial curvature perturbation, essentially roughly around the distance to the last scattering surface, just to show that it's possible. This assumes adiabaticity. We've not looked for non-Gauss entity modes in isocurvature perturbations, which will be something to do. But at this point, we've limited the analysis to adiabatic. And for that restriction, we can do very well. At this point, the non-Gauss entity constraints are the highest precision tests of standard inflation. With Planck now, they are down to about a 0.1% level in terms of the amplitude of the perturbations. Flatness is in second place, with now of order 0.1% constraints. And isocurvature constraints are roughly at the 1% level. If you believe that standard inflation produces adiabatic perturbations, then the isocurvature constraint is relevant. If you believe inflation predicts a flat universe, then the flatness constraint is relevant. If you believe that inflation predicts Gaussian perturbations, then you have a 0.01% test of that. So to know what we're looking for, let's see what a non-Gaussian universe looks like. I will look at this model, the local FNL model, local non-Gaussian entity model, where you have a Gaussian, you can think of it as a Gaussian linear term, and then a second term, which is just the square of this multiplied, scaled by a parameter FNL. Now, you can easily calculate the three-point function from that. Turns out to be just a product of power spectra, two power spectra for this particular model. But there are many other kinds of models you could take. You've seen examples in the last talk. I will show some as well. And you can then take this initial bispectrum and translate it into a bispectrum signature, or as I've sometimes called it, a bispectrum fingerprint of a certain model in the CMB, through just convolving these primordial perturbations with the CMB transfer functions. So what does this look like? So this is a simulation where this is this quadratic term, non-Gaussian term, Each one gives rise to an anisotropy after convolution with the transfer functions. You add them together, and then this will be a non-Gaussian signal. When you look for this tiny signal in this Gaussian noise, in a 1D universe, this shows what happens. So you get build up some intuition for this. This is if you take a large wavelength mode in a 1D universe, and you also have some short wavelength fluctuations on top of that, then when you calculate this formula for this particular model, what you actually find is that you enhance structure in regions of high potential, so in cold spots on the CMB, in the large-scale regime, and you smooth structure, a smaller amplitude apparently, in regions of low potential, which translate into large-scale hotspots on the CMB. So what does this look like in the actual map? This is a Gaussian simulation. And if I put add non-Gaussianity with the FNL factor of 10, which is relevant for the current constraints from Planck, then this happens. And if you saw a change, then your eyes are better than mine. This is for 100. And the plot shifts a little bit, but there's really no change visible. But for 1,000, if you sit up at the front, you can actually see some change. And if you blow it up to 10,000, you see it very clearly. You should see this very enhanced structure in the large-scale cold spots and smoothing on the large-scale hot spots. So this is one example of non-Gaussianity. It's the local case, which is interesting, because it's uniquely produced at a large level in certain multi-field models, such as the curvatron model, or in ekparatic and cyclic models, which also can be mapped onto, at least in certain cases, onto a multi-field situation. So Paul has and James have explained these plots, and they've shown these. So these just show the different templates for a local type non-Gaussianity in bispectral space. This is equilateral type, which probes non-canonical kinetic terms or higher derivative terms in the Lagrangian. And this is orthogonal type, very closely related to this one, which distinguishes between different variants of models with higher derivative terms. So here are these CMB templates, and they derive, again, as has been shown in the previous talk, from these primordial perturbations, primordial bispectra. Here are the corresponding ones. These are then slices. So for a scale invariant, you can just slice through these equivalent three-dimensional plots, but now for the K-modes, get these slices, and then a large range of other models, which were studied in this analysis. And as you've heard just now, with the modal decomposition. So this is discussed in Paul's talk. So how do we actually do these measurements? This is the standard form of bispectrum estimator for a coefficient, for example, such as the local FNL. But this is quite general. What you have is your theoretical template, here, which looks like what I just showed you. Then here's the M dependence of this template if you assume isotropy, isotropic universe. Then here's the data bispectrum, correctly weighted for minimum variance. And then there's a linear term which reduces the variance of this cubic term in cases where your observations, something about the observational strategy introduces anisotropy in the data. For example, if you have anisotropic noise, or you only look on some parts of the sky, as we do with Planck. So the challenges in implementing this estimator are basically three, but I will actually discuss a fourth one because it's relevant to some discussion that has happened since the release. So one is that foregrounds, and this is an exaggerated view of the foregrounds, of course, with the highest frequency channels, with dust heavily dialed up. But foregrounds look very non-Gaussian, even to the eye. And so you have to go from contaminated data set to foreground clean data set in order to be able to look at these small signals and get the best constraints possible. Then systematics, of your instrument and of the entire experimental setup, could produce non-Gaussian signals. And then there's just computational challenge as well, how to actually implement this estimator efficiently. And then there's a fourth challenge, which I will try to talk to you about in terms of a fairy tale, which I will now tell you about. So the Planck data spoke, and it had non-zero FNL, but it sounded nothing like CMB. And so the seven little data analysts kept the door locked. And then the Planck data showed its foot under the door. And the linear term required correlated noise treatment for some estimators. And the seven little analysts kept the door locked. And then they asked the Planck data to show its foot at the window. And it was consistent with standard lambda CDM. And so they opened the door, and the wolf ate them all up. Right, so this is the problem I'm trying to show here, is that the problem of the fairy tale of the wolf and the seven little kids is a story about confirmation bias. Right? The wolf shows the painted white foot at the window, and the seven little kids are waiting for their mom to come home, and so they don't ask to see other evidence. They just see what they expect to see, and they open the door, and they're eaten up. And so one thing that I was that the team was very concerned with in this analysis is that we wouldn't just keep analyzing until we found what was theoretically expected. And the strategy to avoid confirmation bias, and I think you will see this come out when you read the non-Gaussianity paper, is to treat the measurement as if it were a detection, even if it's just a constraint. Okay. And that involves, and this is something a bit different from how this has been done traditionally. Traditionally, these kinds of analyses go in, apply an estimator to the data, find some result. If it's null, then you stop and you just quote a constraint. So what we did is we went and actually were quite careful in terms of several layers of tests that I will describe. Coming back to the more prosaic computational challenges, so here's the estimator again. The problem is if you actually want to calculate this in a straightforward fashion, we still wouldn't be done. Scales as the L max to the fifth power, so even for WMAP it was not feasible, but even less so, of course, for Planck. So the key idea is to focus on particular kinds of templates which are factorizable, which allows you to break up these sums and give you a very large speed up. And that makes this analysis possible. And we have different estimators that all use this trick, so it's just a computational trick. And that gives rise to different estimators. And these estimators, even though maybe if you read the paper and you don't pay close attention, you might just think, oh, they're just all different implementations of the same thing for these standard factorizable shapes. In fact, they have different features, and so they are sensitive to different things. So this factorizable template estimator has the advantage of giving an actual exact fit to the bispectrum if the bispectrum itself is separable, as the local FNL estimator is. And that was why we a priori selected this one to be quoted for these three main factorizable shapes, the local, equilateral, and orthogonal. Okay, this is not a posteriori shape. It's just for those shapes, this estimator gives the best possible constraint. It has exactly the right weighting and so forth. But it is limited to these factorizable templates. This modal estimator that featured in the last presentation is essentially a sum of factorizable templates, each one of which smooth but global over the entire range of L, which if you add enough terms and enough coefficients, you can fit arbitrary templates. And this is quite a general decomposition. up to the fact that you have a finite number of templates, which gives you finite, which translates into finite resolution in bispectrum space. You have some freedom to choose basis sets, and you've already seen that there are, you know, you can choose different ones. They give consistent, but in detail, slightly different results. Each mode actually fits globally across the entire L range. So that's a particular feature of this technique. Then the bin technique uses, again, the same idea, but here the templates are block-shaped. So they are sort of local in L space, or you know, they're bin in L space. So they're sensitive to variations that are local in L, but of course not to variations that are much faster, similar to the modal one, not to variations that are much faster than sort of the resolution limit of this binning. So just to give you a sense of how these different estimators compare with each other, I'll talk about one more in a little bit. The strategy, again, was to prepare for this analysis using simulations. And all the estimators that wanted to participate in this analysis had to pass a suite of simulation challenges, both for Gaussian and non-Gaussian simulations. So they tested, for example, that each one of these estimators gave results that are consistent with each other for individual maps, not just in average, but actually on individual maps gave results that agreed with each other. That they were robust to foreground residuals. They didn't somehow uniquely respond to certain systematics. And the ability to find and accurately measure an unknown non-Gaussianity that was injected in a blind simulation with quite a lot of realism. These are these FFP6 simulations that you've read about now in the Planck papers. They include foregrounds, they include correlated noise, quite realistic compared to the instrument. They take all the flagging of the actual data set, calculate realistic band passes, and even implement asymmetries in the main beams. So these are relatively realistic simulations. And these estimators had to pass the test of finding the correct level of non-Gaussianity, which was in there, that had not been revealed to the collaboration. And they all did. So these results that I will show you in a minute had to pass an extensive validation campaign. And you've heard the results in the previous talk, so I'm not unnecessarily keeping you in the dark here. And this whole slew of estimators, this one is a generalization of this estimator, which simply breaks up this large sum over L into subsums. So it gives you some sensitivity to shape visually, allows you to visualize the data against theoretical predictions in a 1D way. And this is yet another estimator, which is completely different, does not fall into the same category as the ones I've described. And it was important to us to include it, because it shows that there isn't something fundamentally wrong somehow with this L space analysis that I've described to you. Okay, then in the suite of validation tests, we showed that multiple foreground cleaning methods agree with each other. I'll show you the results of that in a minute. That there's negligible impact of foreground residuals. That null tests pass when you take data and you subtract it in such a way that you actually subtract out the signal. You don't somehow respond to certain features in the noise or systematics or survey-to-survey variations. And that the results have the expected resolution dependence. So if you limit your analysis to low resolutions of previous experiments, or if you look at the frequency dependence of the results, or if you change the mask, that all of this fits together. Here's one example. I'm not going to go through an exhaustive list of these tests for you, but here's one that I found very convincing, which is that that shows the Planck data. All of this is Planck data. The bispectrum estimator for the local FNL truncated at a range of different LMAX. So here's the result that you see quoted in the paper. If you are surprised by its value, then it's because this is before the subtraction of the ISW lensing bias. So it gives a value of about 10 when you don't subtract. that known contribution. But if you limit the analysis to a low Lmax, you actually recover the large value seen by WMAP. The WMAP9 paper, the equivalent number would be 40 plus or minus 20, which we see when we truncate the analysis at around 500 or so. So in that sense, the Planck constraints are very consistent with the WMAP constraints. And it just appears to be the case that for this particular shape, you essentially get a random walk as you add more modes. Planck has about 10 times more modes than WMAP. And you know, there's a 2 sigma excursion, as random walks will occasionally have. So here's the Planck bispectrum, as shown in the modal decomposition that you've seen before. This is with SMECA, which is a foreground cleaning method, which was essentially highlighted as the front runner for non-Gaussianity analysis, where you needed very high resolution. Some of the other methods didn't quite go up to the same resolution, with the same low residuals. And you've seen this as well. This just shows consistency across these different foreground separation methods. Here's a slice. Now, this is based on the Smin bispectrum estimator, a slice through L space, through the bispectrum space, just showing, again, the consistency between these foreground separated maps. Very, very mild variations. This is a fourth foreground separation technique that is doesn't go quite as quite high resolution. So this gives slightly fainter, image in this comparison. They're all normalized to the same range, range of color. And this is the raw map, which is clearly different from the others. And you see that in the raw data, there are, if you look at the same parts of the sky as for the foreground separated analyses, you see that there's clearly non-Gaussianity in the data when you don't clean. So to address this issue, we actually looked at the raw data and compared it to the foreground separated, the foreground clean data, but limited the sky area to just 1/3 of the sky, to the cleanest 1/3 of the sky. And while there is some variation, of course, with frequency, that cleaning doesn't get rid of all contaminants, it's clear that in the least foreground contaminated channels, the results are consistent with what we find from the foreground clean results. Of course, also with larger error bars, simply because you cut the data more. So even if we don't do anything fancy with foreground separation, we do get results that are consistent. So here are the results, and I won't read out every single number on this table. The numbers quoted in the abstract are shown here. The main point of this table is to show that so when you look at this ISW lensing subtracted result, the point of this table is that you see four times the same numbers. And so the estimator, the difference between, actually 12 times the same numbers, I should say, the difference between different estimators and the difference between different foreground separation methods are not significant. In fact, we model the difference between different estimators that are expected from a statistical point of view, and they all passed this test. Okay, going to yet another look at this. This is now just for FNL local, which in some ways is the trickiest one to get right. Here's another approach to this, where if you look at Minkowski functionals, this is an image from Andy Kuh's PhD thesis. If you look at Minkowski functionals, these are excursion sets of, here's essentially the anisotropy, and you fill water into it up to some level, and you look at the islands, and you count up things like the area of the bits that stick up above the water level, or the boundary length, or you calculate the genus, or the number of disconnected components. So these kinds of morphological quantities, if you do that for a number of different thresholds, you actually get information about the non-Gaussianity. And while this is not an optimal estimator, it does give a consistent result with a larger error bar. But there isn't something that somehow tricks us just because we're focusing on these L-space results. I'm going to go very quickly for the next couple of slides, because this has just been shown by Paul and James, where you can get these constraints on parameters in the Lagrangian for an effective field theory parameterization of inflationary model space. And that gives you constraints on the speed of sound in these. And here's another constraint plot for quasi-single field models. Again, I won't go into the details since it's already been covered. But we live there very consistent with zero. It's the best constraint, and these are the constraint regions. OK, just one word on another result, which you could argue actually goes into the category of checks of isotropy rather than non-Gaussianity, because it looks at the four-point function. There is a prediction for a type of non-Gaussianity for a four-point function, non-zero, non-trivial four-point function for the local FNL model. The coefficient of that is often called tau NL, which is related to just simply FNL squared times a prefactor. You can look for that signal. The mathematics of this are very analogous to looking for the lensing signal, essentially the same mathematics, which is fitting a overall modulation function to a, you assume that, so this would look like an overall modulation of a otherwise isotropic CMB. We do know that there has to be some anisotropy because we have a kinematic dipole that shows up in this analysis. But when you remove it, you get the red line. The shaded areas here are simulations. The green line shows what you would expect for tau NL of 1,000. The dotted black is, that's right, sorry. And this is the noise bias. So the dotted black line shows for tau NL has this shape. So you're trying to constrain things that look like this. And while there is a anomalous peak here at L equals 3, it doesn't look anything like tau NL. So the analysis puts a constraint on tau NL of less than 2,800 at 95% confidence level. So the summary of the Planck per module non-Gaussianity results is that slowly rolling single scalar field inflation models are favored by the Planck data. Multi-field models are not ruled out. There is a window for them, but they're also not detected. This curvatron decay fraction is larger than 15%. The sound speed is constrained to be larger than 0.02, so there's also still some room, but constraints are getting tighter. And the Planck map is consistent with the standard Bunch-Davies vacuum, as you've seen before. I gather the correct statement is that Planck strongly constrains a class of ekparatic and cyclic models, those with ekparatic conversion, where the entropic conversion happens during the smoothing phase of the ekparatic scenario, and exponential potentials. So that doesn't cover it for the non-Gaussianity in the Planck data. There's a late time bispectrum, which is of great interest, which is probing a very specific physical effect, which is the erasure of structure caused by late time inflation. This creates a non-Gaussian signal because the lensing of the CMB tracks where structures are, and the ISW effect tells you how potentials move, and showing that structures are being erased gives rise to this effect. And that is found by Planck at the 2.6 sigma level. If you look at this nice visualization of the Planck bispectrum and you compare it with this ISW lensing template, you see these characteristic oscillations there. They're not highly significant, but you can imagine that they're at least consistent. Here's a view of the same thing. If you take the KSW estimator and you break it up into contributions from different L, this is the ISW lensing template, and these are the data points. They are highly correlated. But nevertheless, it's quite clear that at least not doesn't seem wildly inconsistent with this ISW lensing signal. Now, in the spirit of avoiding confirmation bias, is it possible that some of the processing that goes into the time ordered data removes non-Gauss entity? That in fact there is non-Gauss entity in the data, but somehow the way that we've analyzed the data has actually cleaned it out. I think that's very difficult to imagine. Of course, the final answer to this analysis involves a fully realistic simulation that puts all the systematics in the data and then cleans them out again and so forth. But any removal of such non-Gauss entity would have to occur exclusively at high L because we reproduce the WMAP results at low L. And if there is such a removal of non-Gauss entity by the TOD processing, it clearly preserved the lensing signal. You've heard we'll hear much more about lensing later on. We already heard some about it this morning, which is a four-point signal and is non-Gaussian. There's also a very clear detection of the cosmic infrared background correlation with lensing, which is actually in many ways like a squeezed bispectrum. And that's seen at very high level of significance. This is in the this is when you filter the data to isolate this CIB signal. Of course, we filter the data to get rid of the signal. But both of these are seen with high significance in Planck data, so it's hard to imagine that somehow just the primordial signal is cleaned out by the time order data processing. And we also see this ISW lensing bispectrum as bispectrum consistent with expectations from standard lambda CDM. That's also a squeezed shape like local. And we also detect a point source bispectrum at 5 sigma. So that somehow made it through the processing. So it's, while this is not conclusive evidence that there could be some bizarre way in which you could pass all of these ways and still remove somehow primordial non-Gauss entities, it's hard to see for me. But this is not the end of the story. There is further discovery potential. There's a slightly higher variance in these. This is for the modal estimator, and this was shown just now. Where the slightly higher variance in these modal coefficients than you would expect for a Gaussian field. And I've shown you that in these coefficients, there are actually detections of non-Gaussian entity hiding. The point source spectrum hides in there. It's quite significant, 5 sigma. The ISW lensing bispectrum hides in there. It's roughly it's just under 3 sigma. So if you have the right model that produces a certain kind of bispectrum, this does not say that the Planck data are absolutely Gaussian. There is large discovery potential in the Planck bispectrum. You've heard about these hints of an oscillatory feature. It's not yet significant given the fact that we studied a lot of models. So let me conclude. Slowly rolling single scalar field models are looking quite good, at least in terms of models. I know there are debates about the whole scenario, the paradigm. The new constraint volume, just as a fun fact, in the three shape space of local, equilateral, orthogonal, reduces by a factor of 20 compared to pre-Planck. We do see non-primordial, non-Gaussian entity at levels consistent with expectations, and these results together constitute a robust and currently the highest precision tests to date of the physical mechanism for the formation of structure in the early universe. Thank you.
Maybe this is a naive question, but a lot of the constraints you see of the W for dark energy, you see that there's a degeneracy that allows it to run off to quite large negative values, which is, you might cut off with the physics prior, but, from an observational point of view, you want to let it float. Does the ISW non-Gaussianity give you some control over that? Because it would tell you that the ISW effect is presumably lessened in that case because the dark energy is turned on much more quickly and much more recently, so that those potentials wouldn't have changed so much as the photons pass through them.
So of course, this effect is not just It's a gradient effect, it's a change derivative effect, right, of the change of the potential. So even if the dark energy switches on late, if it switches on quickly, it will still give rise to a large ISW effect. But it's absolutely true that the ISW lensing bispectrum contains cosmological information, and it gives a constraint, I would say, roughly at the same level at this point. It gives a result of roughly the same level of significance as the measurement of ISW on large scales. So it's complementary, it adds to that, and those two together could constrain the cosmological parameters in the dark energy phenomenology. I look forward to, it's not currently included in the likelihood, but I think that's something we're seriously looking at, and might be something we'd see in follow-up analyses. Well, it's a 3 sigma, it's a 3 sigma contribution to the likelihood. Could be of that order, with better data. But it's going to be a mild constraint.
Okay. So about this excess bispectrum, you showed in a previous slide, or maybe, so this FN, capital FN square. So that one. So am I reading correctly that you are actually sensitive to foreground subtraction this level?
Yes. So these are different foreground separation methods. Of course, you get slightly different results. There will be somewhat sensitive. So this is looking at the entire bispectrum.
So if you took, for example, 7, then you wouldn't claim that there's excess variance in there.
Well, you wouldn't really. I mean, if you look at all the other ones, they are also not hugely discrepant, right? We're not making a claim that there's some unexplained large non-Gaussianity in the data.
You kept saying that there is excess variance. Now, a previous speaker also said that, right? But I wanted to just be cautious here because, first of all, it's 2 sigma to begin with, and if you took 7, it's 1 sigma.
If you had one that was going oscillating just around this line, it's still true that with the large number of bispectral modes that we measure, if you have the right model, you can pick up the right number. You can pick up a huge number of sigma. So the statement that there's discovery potential in the bispectrum is actually fairly independent of this plot. This just shows that there is some excess variation, which depends a little on the foreground separation method used. But of course, foregrounds do produce.
But I don't understand because significant change by factor of 2, and I don't know why you call that. It's like
it's yeah. These are not independent. I mean, this is the. It's not. These are not separate. This is not independent for L. Like this is just a single number that's shown broken up across L. Right, somewhere quite low, I suppose.
Yes, somewhat related question. WMAP did analysis for the usual templates with the unclean map and found that the shift was very minor. So, saying that, meaning that I interpreted that foregrounds don't play a big issue there. Instead, now, what is the situation with Planck? That is, if you.
Well, I showed the results, right? So if you mask the sky a lot, you get consistent results with what we found in the cleaned maps. What you mean by a lot is also related to the error bar. So if
compared to the sigma, statistical sigma.
So compared to the statistical sigma, of course, it's a much more demanding question with Planck because the error bar is now 3 times smaller, roughly, than it was with WMAP. So I'm confident that the foreground clean results are much higher quality than what you could get on this much smaller region on the sky, looking at just the raw results. But I've shown those numbers, and they do give consistent answers, but the error bars go up.
One question. Ben, I have a question. So your tau and L, you showed some constraints on tau and L. How consistent are they with the measurement of dipolar power asymmetries? Because they are sensitive to the same thing.
Right, they're sensitive to the same thing. So we had, I don't think that has been resolved yet. Maybe Chris will say more about this in his presentation. about the, especially if we say exactly about the power asymmetry in the sky.
Yeah, so a lot of these results seem to differ in these foreground models, right, for a lot of these analyses, including the low L, actually.
What do you mean? Sorry.
Well, I mean, just this plot, right? The different...
Very, very, very mild. I mean, basically, it's you're saying that if you take all of the bispectrum modes, right, with absolutely no filtering, with no taking into account the fact that they've been, you know, if they're primordial, they have to be processed through through the transfer functions and so forth. This is just, you know, this is just looking at the raw data, the raw bispectrum. I'm absolutely amazed that three different foreground separation methods give you results that are consistent at this level.
Right, but there's still a difference, right? And similar difference, which is fine. So let me ask the question, which is, the question is, you know, how much effort has been made into really exploring all of the possible foreground models? How, in other words, how do we know that these three are really representative for the range of cases that can happen, as opposed to, you know, anything else that could happen?
So I, I can answer that question. So these methods have funny names, but they represent what we think is a complete battery of weapons to look for the CMB solution in the data. Okay, so namely, there is a talk on Thursday which will comment on these things, but they're basically pixel-based parameterization and fitting of foregrounds, harmonic-based parameterization and fitting of foregrounds, internal linear combination, and template fitting. Okay, so they are representative of what we think are the best approaches developed so far in the literature for looking for the CMB solution in the data. They're also very different from each other, totally independent implementation. So I agree with Ben, it was amazing to see such a consistency, although, of course, there are differences in residuals of foregrounds in the different methods, because they are different. Differences in residuals. On the solution of the CMB, we have consistency on all the checks that we did.
Yeah, I guess my point is more that the errors in the foreground modeling should somehow be propagated into this analysis, right? And instead, these are just fixed maps without propagation of the errors on the foreground modeling onto the final result.
No.
I mean, you fix the foreground model, no, right?
The foreground models, so these are the solution on foreground with the foregrounds in the data. Okay, so at least for two of these things, the solution comes from parametric fitting. So in parametric fitting, you get the errors on the chains, on foreground parameters and the CMB solution. So these error estimation, because of you're looking at solution in a Markov chain way, okay? So you're getting uncertainty after you assume a model, you get error on the parameters of that model.
Let me just
say something, Ben. Everybody's right. Urosh is right. Carlos is right. Ben's right. What's missing on Ben's plot is commander set of results. That's the parametric method which actually propagates everything correctly. Incessant drive for high resolution and sensitivity on foreground corrected CMB maps has reduced everything to presenting plots like this one and commander dropping because it's actually not performing as well at very high Ls, which is mostly irrelevant for the scope of what has been discussed on that particular plot, in my opinion. So anyway, methodology is in hand. Hans Christian sitting there. I was going to be talking about it. It's not true that we don't propagate errors. We do it better than anybody else.
I would like to add a comment on this. I mean, the purpose that we actually, that we had this full range of methods, including the full blind ones, okay, which don't propagate. I mean, that's quite right. I mean, they don't propagate, but they are fully blind. And you can take the differences as the sort of level of the uncertainties that they are using essentially all the component separation method there is on the planet as of today. So you can judge. And precisely that was the reason that rather than just showing one, you could essentially do exactly what you just said. you know, this is the level of flexibility that is residual, that is left.
Yeah, so.
And that doesn't change very much, the constraints.
So François made half of my point for me. A couple of these methods are blind methods, so there you can actually throw more parameters at the data and nothing much changes. So you have some control over over that. When you look at this range of methods, as Carlos said, that actually cover quite a large range in this in the methodology space for doing this analysis, you see the differences here, right? For example, and remember that errors add in quadrature. So if we marginalized over these, I mean, we only have three samples in some sense, I agree, but if you do a poor man's marginalization over the foreground uncertainty, you wouldn't change the error bars. So you add in quadrature. And the reason why this one is maybe slightly different in some ways, I mean, these are just amazingly consistent. This one is a little bit different, but it also covers a different L range. It essentially covers only L up to, roughly speaking, 1,500, whereas the other ones go to 2,500, which means that the effect of the random walk with including more modes would just have some additional effect, which is also represent, you know, which you see in slightly larger error bar there. So you're, I think that this is an astounding level of consistency. I'm surprised to hear that you think that, that there's some discrepancy staring you in the face.
I was just wondering if you could explain why the error bar in equilateral didn't improve by the factor of 3 that you might have expected. It was less than 2 compared to WMAP.
I'm not sure about that. Right, so yeah, local just basically grows only because you go out to higher L. It's a good question. I don't know. I have to check that. I'm more concerned with making sure the numbers are right than in this case. I'm not sure why we didn't quite as much reduction maybe as you would just guess from the number of node values. But you do get that from local.
Okay, let's thank Ben again, and we're breaking for lunch.